This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jimmy Carter was the first American president to tell the public that he was born again. But he believes in the separation of church and state and is worried that the wall is eroding. In his new book, Our Endangered Values, he draws on his experiences as president and as a Baptist to explain his concerns about the intertwining of politics and religion. President Carter, welcome back to Fresh Air. Do you think the line between church and state has shifted since you were president?
Well, this separation of church and state, which Thomas Jefferson ordained as a wall between the two, has been severely breached in the last 15 or 20 years, in particular in the last 5 years. So the answer is yes. When I was president, and I think all my predecessors and most of my successors have been meticulous in trying to separate church and state and not inject religious aspects into policy and not let the churches or any religion dominate or heavily influence the political decisions made by this government. So this is a radical departure from what we've seen in our country since its founding.
Are there times where you feel President Bush has eroded the line between church and state?
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt that the nation knows that President Bush, as president, strongly favors the religious right, Protestant Christians in our country. There's no doubt about this, in my opinion. But the religious part is not the most important. I think that's the background or the foundation for a lot of changes. But the major changes that concern me are more secular in nature. For instance, we have always had a policy in our country of peace. That is, that our country would not go to war and attack another country, bomb its people, invade that nation, unless our own security was directly threatened. That's been abandoned under this administration. And now the new policy is preemptive war, which the president declared at West Point, as you know, a couple of years ago. Our country now, because of its tremendous military might, reserves a right, publicly declared, to invade another country, to attack another country, to kill its citizens, not if our nation is security is endangered, but if we want to change the regime there for some reason. We've also abandoned our longstanding and admirable commitment to civil liberties and personal privacy of Americans and the protection of human rights around the world. This has not only been a matter of great pride to America, but it's also compatible with international law. And we now see a struggle within the Congress at this moment to permit the CIA, for instance, to torture prisoners. This is in direct violation of longstanding principles of our country, moral values, and also in direct violation of international agreements. So the radical change in America's domestic and international policies are what I'm trying to cover in saying that our endangered values are America's moral crisis and around the world.
You were the first president to say that you were born again. This was, and you said that during the election when you were asked by a reporter.
Yes.
After you proclaimed that you were born again, how did that change perceptions of you?
It was a very serious mistake for me to make. I was actually in the backyard of a friend in North Carolina, and I was asked, are you a born-again Christian? And I answered truthfully, yes, I am. I had always assumed that phrase was completely acceptable, at least among Christians. And there were news reporters there. It was kind of late in the 76 campaign, and it was reported, and the reaction was very severe and negative because the people who were not familiar with that phrase assumed that I was claiming to have some special endowment from God in visions, and that I also tended to elevate myself above all other human beings in my moral standards, which was not the case at all. Being a born-again Christian had been a phrase I used since I was probably 3 or 4 years old, as used regularly in Christian churches in my area. So it was a very negative reaction to what I had to say. And I was very careful from then on to separate openly and ostentatiously my religious faith from any responsibilities that I assumed when I became president.
How active do you think the Christian right was in 1976
They were non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
They were really non-existent then. There were a few statements made from some people that would now be called a Christian right, but they were insignificant. I think it was probably 3 or 4 years later before, I think, Time or Newsweek magazine, I've forgotten, had a front cover story on the birth of the Christian right. And in my own denomination, I was a Southern Baptist, it was the election of a president of a Southern Baptist Convention in 1979 that brought about a change in our own denomination. It took 10 years or so to completely implement what they espoused as fundamentalist. But it was not culminated until the year 2000. And at that time, a new doctrine was established, was adopted in the Southern Baptist Convention like a creed, and that creed has now been imposed on Baptists. And, of course, Baptists have been non-creedal people since the founding of our faith many, many years ago. But those were the changes that have taken place.
When you were president, did you ever find that your political position and your religious views ever came into conflict?
Yes. There was one issue in particular that was a very serious problem for me, and that was abortion. I have never believed that Jesus Christ, whom I worship, would approve abortions unless the mother's health or life was threatened, or perhaps if the pregnancy was from rape or incest. This is hard for me to accept. And at the same time, I was sworn by oath to uphold the laws and Constitution of the United States as interpreted by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court had ruled that that abortions in the first semester of pregnancy were completely acceptable. So I tried to do everything I could within the bounds of the law to minimize and discourage abortions. As a matter of fact, one of the easily understood principles is that two-thirds of the women who have abortions claim, at least, that the reason is that they cannot financially support another child. So I developed what's known as a Women Infant Children's Program, WIC program, to give special benefits to women and infant and pregnant women and infant children. Also, I promoted the proposition that adoption should be easier, and I tried to promulgate training for in high school on ways to avoid unwanted pregnancy. But I had to uphold the law. So that particular one was troublesome for me. Another that was legally troublesome for me that didn't really ever come into effect was the Supreme Court's ruling shortly before I became president that authorized a death penalty. That had been prohibited as unfair. But when the Supreme Court ruled, luckily, I went through my entire term as governor and my entire term as president, and no one was executed under my administrations. And I have never felt that Jesus Christ, again, would approve the death penalty as it's presently supported so strongly by some of the conservative Christians and others in this country. Those are the two issues.
With abortion, since you personally oppose abortion but upheld a woman's right to abortion because the Supreme Court ensured that right. Did you ever state your views on abortion? Did you feel like you should speak out against abortion as you continued to uphold the right to abortion?
Yes, I did frequently. As a matter of fact, I cover this in the book. On one occasion, I was questioned at one of my fairly frequent White House press conferences about the fact that rich women could buy abortions and that poor women didn't have a right to an abortion unless the federal government paid for them. And I made the remark that was somewhat criticized, and I can see why, that sometimes life is unfair. That's not a very good statement for a president to make. But that was the way I felt. I didn't think it was right for our country to support abortions by paying for abortions if it was just to end a pregnancy when the mother's life or safety was not endangered.
Now, you mentioned that when you publicly stated that you were born again when you were running for president, that it worked against you. People misunderstood what you meant by that, and you thought it hurt you in the election. It's funny because, you know, President Bush is born again. He discussed that when he was running for office, and, you know, it seemed to help him very much in his campaign. So would you reflect a little bit about what's changed?
Well, what's changed is what I described earlier. That is, the rise of fundamentalism has affected both politics, including national policy in domestic and foreign affairs, and also has affected the religious community much more than it ever did when I was in politics. And the two have now merged. So there is an ostentatious and very aggressive effort among the, you might say, the religious right leaders, and I don't criticize them because of their beliefs, publicly to align themselves with the Republican Party, provided the Republican Party members whom they support are adequately conservative. So that marriage has been a radical departure, in my opinion, from the ancient values of our country. At the same time, through various means, some of them not well publicized, there has been a tremendous amount of taxpayers' money that is being sent directed to churches in our country, and the argument has been, can the churches be discriminatory against people who receive services through them from taxpayers' money? And the present administration's policy is that we should not make the churches declare non-discrimination. Let them discriminate. So these two factors are unprecedented in our country, and I think they contravene the basic premises on which our country was founded, as espoused most clearly by Thomas Jefferson, who advocated a wall between church and state.
You're a Baptist, and you say in your book that Southern Baptists had been committed to the separation of church and state, and that the church abhorred the concept of churches becoming involved in the partisan world. And this is when you were growing up. Why was that there, that rejection of getting involved in the political partisan world?
Well, when I was a little child, my father was a Sunday school teacher, and it was inculcated in me and the other students then that the basic origins of the Baptist Church in this country were for independence from government, and that we would not abide by government ordaining a particular denomination, a particular faith, or a particular church to be dominant, as had happened in Europe. In fact, that's why a lot of people came over. Roger Williams founded our church in this particular country. Also, the Baptists have always been a non-creedal organization, and that means that not only is every individual church congregation autonomous or sovereign, but that every individual human being has a right to go directly to God through prayer and to relate directly with God. So we avoided any sort of creed to be imposed on us by an outside power. And the Southern Baptist Convention itself has now departed from that. And in the year 2000, as I mentioned earlier, adopted a very severe creed that is now must be adopted officially by anyone who serves as a pastor in a church, who serves as a missionary overseas, who has a job as administrator or teacher in one of the Southern Baptist Convention's own seminaries to teach students, and so forth. So we have departed, I'm afraid, in many ways from those religious policies.
You and Rosalind left the Southern Baptist Conference. Was it because of this new creed?
Yes, because of a new creed and some of the elements of it. Two things that I didn't mention that caused me concern was that in the old statements that Baptists used to use, very lax, it said that the interpretation of biblical verses, there are about more than 30,000 of them, would be for Christians the words and actions of Jesus Christ. That statement was deleted from a new creed. And instead, obviously in effect, the elected leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention would then be the interpreters of the Scripture, and that all subordinates, all people who adhere to that, had to agree. The other thing was their declaration concerning the subservience of women, that women have to be subservient to their husbands. And there now is a prohibition against any woman occupying a position of authority or responsibility within the Southern Baptist Convention. Our most famous and revered heroes when I was a child were people like Lottie Moon, who was a missionary to China. We still give a Lottie Moon Christmas offering throughout the Southern Baptist Convention. Now a woman can't be the lead missionary. A woman can't even be a chaplain, for instance, now in the military forces if she's a Southern Baptist. They have disavowed those policies, and a woman can't speak with authority or teach men in a church. Those are just a couple of the new ordained principles that all Southern Baptists now have to accept in order to be a member of the convention. I couldn't agree to that.
What about the church that you've belonged to in Plains, Georgia for so long, the church in which you've taught Sunday school for so many years? Are the members of that church still members of the Southern Baptist Convention?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, almost all of the members of our church agree with me and what I've just described to you as basic religious principles. What we call the sainthood of the believer, that is, that each individual has a right to worship God directly, that each church has to be autonomous. We have women deacons, and next month we will ordain a woman minister in our church. She'll be the associate member of our church. And we believe that we shouldn't be bound by a creed imposed on us by outside. So the members of my church, still a Baptist church, have these same beliefs that I do, in effect. I can't say that everybody's 100% in agreement with me, but we have open discussions when our congregation gets together, and I think I'm accurately expressing the overwhelming beliefs.
My guest is President Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book called Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis. Let me ask you about evolution, since, you know, intelligent design is before the courts now. How do you deal with the fact that science tells us different things than the Bible does about the creation of men and women and the earth?
Well, in Our Endangered Values, the book, I describe my feelings about this quite thoroughly. I studied nuclear physics when I was a young man. I was one of the originators of a nuclear submarine program. I worked on Admiral Hyman Rickover. At the same time, as you've already mentioned, I'm a devout Christian. I don't see any incompatibility at all between the two. My belief is that God created the universe. My belief is that God permits us to understand the new developments that we can witness in universal matters. When the Bible was written, we didn't have the Hubble telescope. We didn't have microscopes so we could look at small items. We didn't have a way to test the age of rocks and so forth. And now we have these scientific capabilities. And so I think that science is just a revelation of God's creation. And so the two are completely separate, and we can't prove the existence of things in our faith. As a matter of fact, the definition of faith in the Bible is that we know things that cannot be proven. Well, we don't have to have faith to believe that the moon is out there. That's something that we can see for ourselves. And we can't have science prove the existence of God or all of the things that we know about Jesus Christ as a Christian. So the two are separate. I don't believe there's any place in a scientific classroom to try to prove to the students that God exists. I think the two ought to be completely separate. So I believe in both of them, the science and religion, the two are completely separate. One should not be imposed on the other.
You write in your book that one of the most bizarre mixtures of religion and government is the strong influence of some Christian fundamentalists on U.S. policy in the Middle East. And you're referring there to Christians who believe in the rapture, that the second coming of Jesus is imminent, and that those who are born again will ascend to heaven when the second coming arrives, and everyone else will be left behind to face the tribulations. And Israel is important in this formula. What is Israel's place in this?
Well, what the people believe that you've just described is that Israel must take over the complete Holy Land, that is Gaza and all the West Bank, so that the Temple on the Mount, for instance, can be destroyed and the Temple of Israel be replace it, and other matters of that kind. And then in the end, when the rapture occurs and the chosen people by God have been taken miraculously and instantaneously to heaven, and all the rest of us, or them, will be condemned to Hades, at that time, all the Jews, according to this principle, will either be converted to Christianity or burned. And so the ultimate goal of these people, the ultimate belief of these people, I'm sure they're very sincere and devout, is that Judaism will be terminated completely, and that every Jew will have to be a Christian or have to die. Well, I think that some of the Jewish leaders are willing to accept the proposition that Jews take over the West Bank and colonize the entire area of Palestinian land, but they don't look at the final premise on which this philosophy is based.
So you're surprised that there are Israelis and Jewish American supporters who are forming alliances with the Christian right.
I'm not surprised.
Oh, okay.
I'm not surprised. I think that they're willing to take this financial help and this encouragement for some of the more conservative Jewish leaders to colonize the West Bank. And I think they just ignore as a fallacy, an unproven premise, that ultimately they will suffer either death or have to become a Christian. I think they're ignoring the ultimate consequence under the belief that it's probably not going to happen. But they're willing to take the immediate benefits.
After Hurricane Katrina destroyed some of the oil infrastructure along the Gulf Coast, President Bush made a speech in which he asked Americans to turn down their thermostats and carpool and do other things to conserve energy. Now, when you made your time to conserve energy speech when you were president, people mocked you for it. And in fact, some people thought it contributed to your losing your reelection campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that speech and what you were hoping to accomplish by giving it, and what your reaction was to the reaction you got after you gave it?
Well, I had to fight the oil crisis throughout my 4 years as president, and even when I was a governor. And President Richard Nixon was president. We had boycotts against the sale of oil to us because we were friendly toward Israel. And under President Nixon and under me, again, there were long lines at service stations waiting for gasoline. The last 12 months of my term, the price of oil skyrocketed, much greater increase than it has been in the last 12 months or so, because Iraq invaded Iran, and all the oil from Iraq and Iran was terminated from the world supplies. So I was very seriously and adversely affected as an incumbent president, and so was our nation, by a sustained crisis concerning oil. My main thrust was to conserve oil, to conserve energy. And I worked out, just I'll give you one example to save time, with the Congress and with the oil companies, and primarily with automobile manufacturers, to require the increase of the efficiency of automobiles from 12 miles per gallon when I became president. And we established in the law an increase to 27.5 miles per gallon. When I went out of office, inadvertently and against my will, as you know, because of the 1980 election, that policy was basically terminated. And under President Reagan and his successors, the requirement for efficient automobiles has been lost. Now, of course, the big SUVs and Hummers and so forth don't come under any sort of restraints at all. And American motor vehicles use about 40% of our total oil, and we've become heavily dependent again on foreign oil. So that's what I had to struggle with, and that's what President Bush is addressing now. President Bush has not been willing to impose any kind of restraints on the efficiency of automobiles.
Let me get back to the speech. You wore a cardigan. Everybody always mentions that when they mention the speech. He was wearing a cardigan. You talked about the importance of turning down the thermostat and conserving energy. What did you think the reaction of the American public was going to be?
Well, as a matter of fact, if you look at the record, which I've done fairly often, in the 4 years, we were able to impose into law a profoundly important set of standards for efficiency, for insulation of homes, for the efficiency of stoves and refrigerators and other appliances, for electric motors used in industry, as well as the motor vehicles that I've described already to you. So despite the constant altercation about it, both Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate approved my basic proposals, and we did implement those issues. So my hope and my expectation when I made this speech in my cardigan sweater were realized. And when I left office, there was a profoundly important set of laws imposed and rules imposed, and most of them have survived. The efficiency requirements for electric motors and refrigerator stoves and houses still exist without any attenuation. The basic change has been in motor vehicles, and that's where the present administration has backed away, as well as some of its predecessors.
Well, President Carter, I thank you for talking with us today. Thank you very much.
Terry, it's been a pleasure to be with you on Fresh Air again. It means a lot to me.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called Our Endangered Values. You can hear an excerpt of the audiobook version on our website, freshair.npr.org.